To have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Chatting with Sherry welcomes back Sandra Bornstein. We're going to talk about her new book, 100 Things to Do in Colorado Before You Die, which is a very interesting and fun book. And we're going to talk about travel and the adventure travel and all the different things that are important about going to new places and exploring new things. It's a really fun chat. Here's Sandra. Hi, Sandy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Sherry. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day in sunny Colorado.
Well, it's beautiful here, too, except it's windy and cold.
Well, I should preface that it is a little chilly here, and it did snow overnight, but since it's sunny outside and the altitude, a lot of the snow that fell last night has already melted and dissipated.
Yeah, I remember that when I lived in the Midwest. It depended on the weather, but there were times it would snow and just melt, and then there were times it would pile up. And he didn't really know which type it was. I wasn't big on watching the news when I was a little girl. I just went by what was happening. I didn't watch the news until I was in my teens. I knew what was happening in the world because my parents made sure we knew, but it was, like the moon and going to the moon and all that stuff. My dad made sure we watched that.
Well, it's pretty typical in Colorado if the sun comes out after snowfall for a good part of it to melt, even when it's chilly out. I think when I was out earlier, it was in the 30s, but the sun was bright and the pavement was clean, which is good because I also lived in the Midwest at one point, and oftentimes it took quite a while before you got rid of the snow. You had a lot of black ice and crud and dangerous road conditions.
Yeah, I know. And being brought up in California, I didn't actually see snow till we moved to the Midwest. The first time I actually saw snow, we were going from California to the Midwest, and we were in Flagstaff, Arizona, and it snowed. And we were in a hotel. No, we were in a motel. And my brother and I ran out. It's snowing! And my mom's yelling, "No, don't go out, you have a cold." But he couldn't stop us. We both wanted to go into the snow. It was our first snowfall. It was the first time we ever saw snow. That's a big deal for any little kid.
I think it's a big deal even for adults. You should see the people that come to University of Colorado Boulder and maybe come from California or come from another warmer climate and see snow for the first time. They get very excited.
Oh, yeah.
They're not kids anymore because it's something very, very new and different. And I also know that our daughter-in-law that comes from India, the first time she saw snow in the United States, she found it very fascinating. And she was a mature adult when she came here. So I think it's something that's very intriguing the first time you see it.
Yeah, I remember I have a friend who came. She lived in an inland state, so in another country, and I can't remember which one. And when she saw the Pacific Ocean, she just couldn't stop staring. It was like, oh my God, it's the real ocean. I go, yeah, it's real. I mean, I'm a water baby. Except for when I lived in the Midwest, I lived in the East Coast and the West Coast, and I always had ocean. So to me, it'd be like you in the snow, you know. It's no big deal, but somebody's never seen it. It's like, I don't know. It's a godly moment, I guess, for them. Kind of cool, though, huh?
Yes. Anytime you see anything for the first time, it's kind of a cool thing. Makes you, I think, appreciate life in general.
Mm-hmm.
The complexity of what is available in different parts of the world. And that's how come I love being a travel writer who's been able to travel all over the place, because it opens my eyes to many things, some of which I've read in books, other things that I was totally unfamiliar with. But there's nothing like seeing something firsthand. You can maybe read about a snowfall, but to actually see a snowfall in person is very different. So that's the joy of traveling, to be able to see as much of the world as you can.
Have you ever read about someplace in a book and then been shocked when you saw it? Like, not in a bad way. It's just, I remember when I went to Europe and I was in England and I was going to Bath, and I had read about Baths in Jane Austen and Agatha Christie, and the way they both described it, it's like a little hamlet. But when you go there, it's huge. It's like Los Angeles. It's spread out across all the mountains and everything. I mean, it's humongous. Did you ever go someplace and it was like not exactly what you were expecting because you only got it from a book?
Well, most of my impressions come from fellow travel writers, and oftentimes, I hate to say it, and sometimes it comes from books or movies or whatever. Movies are a little bit more accurate because you can actually
see it.
hopefully it's not a set, it's the actual place.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that oftentimes the people that write about places, unfortunately, have never been there. And so they borrow from other people's works and may embellish or more or less say the same thing. And sometimes the original source, I think, also didn't see or actually visit the place. So there are countless times, I can't tell you, where I'll go online and read, cherry pick different sites and should get an impression of what I should look at or what the best things are and what I should be aware of. And I'll have notes, and sometimes I actually make physical copies of this stuff. And then I'll either get out of my hotel or off a cruise ship or a bus or a train or wherever I am, and I start walking, and it's like, this isn't what I read. The proximities are different. The size, like you said, can be very different. You imagine something being very small and it's very large, or vice versa. So there's this disconnect, I'd say, far too often between what people write about and what you actually can see and in person. And so early on in my travel writing career, I made an effort, if possible, because sometimes I agree to write stories if they are list stories, so they don't give a whole lot of detail. They're more concise. A few sentences about a place. But if I'm able to expound on an area or do a first person narrative of a visit, I try really hard to give my readers an overall description, so they won't be misled when they get there and realize that there's a disconnect between what's written and what is reality. But it takes time, and it takes, taking a lot of notes, and sometimes I don't have the ability to take notes, so I take a lot of crazy pictures. I'll take pictures of the ground, I'll take pictures of just the landscape, just different things, so that when I go back to write about a place, I can remember better the finer details of what I experienced.
I take pictures of
Because,
signs a lot, like where things are,
right, a
like
lot of
directional
signs.
signs. Yeah.
I'll take a lot of pictures of signs. So even though pictures now are time stamped, because many of my pictures are on my phone and I can kind of backtrack and figure out where places are, if I take landmarks or pictures of signs, then I can recall better exactly where I was to retrace my steps. So it's a whole process. I wish I had a better memory, a photographic memory, so I could recall every, minor detail, but I don't. So fortunately, my phone comes in very, very handy
Yeah.
because it records a good part of my journey, so I can then look back at the pictures and come up with an accurate depiction of where I was.
I like places that have like plaques about who lived there or what happened there, because I would take pictures of all of them so I can remember it.
No, I take pictures. I even in a museum, I'll take a lot of pictures of some of the descriptive language, so that I can recall more specifics about inside of museum than, let's say, the museum's website, because I try and avoid, harvesting my material from previously published stuff. I try and get to the finer details of what you hopefully will see if you have a tour of a specific place. Also rely on the help of locals who live there for their insight and their information.
Yeah, one place that's got really good stuff. There's several here in LA, but the one I would remember was the Field Museum in Chicago. They have a lot of great descriptions that are right by whatever the displays are. Really full and clear. They're not behind the glass. They're in front, so they're not kind of, they don't have that distortion from the glass. I don't like that. There's some museums and places and galleries that will put up a sign about the artist or whoever, or if it's a natural museum, the plant or the animal, but it's behind glass. So when you take a picture of it, it's distorted, and you have to be really careful with the picture you're taking. Have you ever found that?
And then it depends on how much, when the exhibits were created, how long ago, what type of technology was used. I mean, I've been to old school museums where the descriptions are typed on sheets of paper and then put behind glass, because they're old. There hasn't been enough money to refurbish the museum or update it, and those are sometimes really hard to capture on with a digital image because of the faded typing as well as the plastic or the glass that you have to shoot through. But some of those museums are have some real good gems in them
Oh, yeah.
that you couldn't imagine would be in such a place. But it's all also obviously about money and how many people go to visit that place and how well they're funded as to how well their signage is. And then other places, you're kind of surprised because small communities that obviously either had outside funding or were had some type of bond issue or something where they were able to get significant funding to create amazing displays and engaging exhibits that interact really well with school-aged children. So I never really know what I'm going to come across, when I walk into a museum, because it varies greatly from location to location.
Do you go to all different kinds? I love all different kinds of museums. I'm just curious.
I try and go to museums that give me a flavor of the community. For instance, when we were in Iceland in the summer, I went to a whale museum because I can't remember the name of the place we were at, and probably would have butchered the name anyways. But they had this famous whale museum that we went into, and it was very fascinating because we had been on a whale ship, chasing a whale around the harbor. Also in Iceland in the summer, we went to an island that was famous for an eruption that took place, I think it was in the 1960s and 1970s, and they created a volcano museum, which was very interesting because it was constructed on top of the excavations of some of the homes that had been buried from the volcano.
God.
So it was very, very fascinating. So those are two instances where I kind of pick museums that kind of describe the history or culture. Other times, I'll be happy to go to a natural history museum that gives an overview of the world in general, not a specific place. So it really depends. Depends on time, depends on location. There's a lot of factors that determine where I end up.
Yeah. I mean, here in San Diego, we have a really good Air and Space Museum. I love going there. And we also have several art museums, and we have a big, huge natural history museum with all these mosaics and all kinds of stuff. I mean, you go to Balboa Park, and you can spend all your time inside because you'll be in all the museums.
Well, and that's also nice because there's some cities that I think really took the time to plan, especially if they were a larger city like San Diego. They were somebody had a lot of foresight and decided to set aside a huge tract of land to basically be the place where all the museums and culture would be, so it'd be convenient for not only locals but visitors. Other cities weren't as fortunate or didn't have the space or whatever. So it all depends, but you're lucky because it's a lot easier when it's a one stop.
Yeah, it is.
Like having to get in your car and drive to six different places. And it also makes it easier for somebody visiting from out of town when things are within walking distance. That's usually more of the case when you have a smaller destination where things are more close together, but it's nice in larger cities when there was some planner who decided, oh, we're going to set aside this tract of land and put X, Y, and Z here.
Well, Balboa Park is really interesting. It has a different kind of history than any place that I know of. Balboa Park was created to do the World's Fair in San Diego. I think it's the 1915 and 1916. It's 2 years in a row. And they created all the facades you still see of buildings from the art museums there and all the different places. But they were facades. They weren't. You couldn't go in them. There were some that you could go in, but it was still made of papier mâché. It wasn't real. And then it was like backed up with some concrete so it would stay up. So what happened was after the two World Fairs, people loved it, and the tourists were coming every year. So they decided to keep this basic outline and create the buildings so that they would stay through earthquakes and make them earthquake proof and all that stuff. And that's when they decide, okay, this one's going to be the Natural History Museum, this is going to be the Art Museum, this is going to be the Science Museum, this will be the Photography Museum. And then they added things to it, like the space and Air and Space Museum and the old Globe Theater that they created and stuff like that. But it all started from a creation for a park for the, and in fact, the zoo, the San Diego Zoo, which is right next to Golden Gate Park, that was part of the World's Fair too. It was like a area with animals, but it also had like, I think there was like a nude exhibit, and boardwalks and shows and all kinds of interesting things. It's just, it's fascinating. If you ever, go ahead.
I know that the location where the Museum of Science and Industry is in the city of Chicago was a building that was part of the 1893 World's Fair.
Isn't that cool?
To the best of my knowledge, the other buildings that were there for the World's Fair were either moved or destroyed. The other buildings that are there are not, to the best of my knowledge, I could be wrong. But I, my gut feeling is that that land was set aside for the World's Fair, and that's where some of the museums right now are. Well, it's a big tract of land, a beautiful tract of land that's, you know, right along
the
shoreline. So,
yeah.
You know, because the way Chicago was developed, they purposely left a lot of land along the shore, along Lake Michigan, that couldn't be built upon, and that's come. You've got, you've lived in Chicago, all those great beaches and all those great parks that extend, you know, from south of Chicago to you know, north to the northern part of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's kind of typical that the World's Fair at least created space, and then sometimes buildings were left behind. I would have thought, now that you're telling me about what happened in San Diego, that maybe they would have left more buildings behind, but maybe they weren't built to you know, long-lasting buildings. They were short-term buildings.
They were all.
I wasn't around in 1893, so I couldn't.
They probably didn't get to them in time, because the architect here was really quick, and our weather is better than in Chicago, so it probably, they got to it quick enough that they could save as many of those buildings and make them stable than they probably could in Chicago, because you got winter and you got wind and
as a child, remember, I did attend the New York World's Fair in the 1960s. I can't tell you exactly what date it was, but it was in the 1960s, and I don't know if any of the I was a small child, so I couldn't even tell you necessarily what I saw. I don't know if any of those buildings, you'd probably have to ask a New Yorker, if any of those buildings that were created for the New York World's Fair survived afterwards. I have no idea, but believe it or not, there was a World's Fair in New York in the 1960s.
There's also they called it an expo in Toronto, and we visited Toronto when I was a kid, and that's all museums and stuff like that. So you're right, I think it's something that they do, but I think they have to do it really quick, so especially if there's a lot of temporary buildings, so they don't lose, if they want the look of the buildings that they had, they can't let them deteriorate before they can do it. They have to do it before it deteriorates so they can reconstruct it. At least that's what I think. I don't know. I wasn't around either.
And actually, I thought of another place. We were in Seville, Spain, in the spring of this year, and there are amazing buildings there. That I think dated to some World's Fair or Expo. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was a World's Fair or an Expo in either the 1920s or 1930s. And the architecture, I can tell you, was absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think whenever possible, they try and maintain some of those structures. But I think maybe if they don't have a use for the buildings, or if they're not constructed to withstand time, they probably don't survive. But I guess you could go around the world and find remnants of different world fairs.
I think that's cool, though. I mean, why not? Why not try to retain all that excitement and beauty? And I think it's a great idea.
So, well, travel, like I said, travel, I know, you know, it's pricey. It's not available to some people. I know some jobs prevent it because of a lack of time off or family or even family obligations. But there is so much history, culture, understanding different types of people, the diversity in the world, understanding even understanding cultures through food, which is one of the genres I also write about. You just learn so much by experiencing personally rather than, let's say, going to a restaurant that's trying to knock off authentic Italian food. They may or may not have somebody who was trained in Italy or has family recipes from that are based in Italian culture, so you really don't know how authentic it is. But when you actually go to like a restaurant in Spain or in Italy or somewhere in South America, you really get to understand that culture or, you know, wherever it is, and also realize how they're dependent on oftentimes what is the recipes are dependent on what was traditionally grown in that area. Obviously with modern technology things, there's great transportation systems, so fruits and vegetables that are not indigenous can be shipped in, or fish can be shipped in if you're inland. But you can really see how a culture developed prior to that by looking at their traditional recipes or what they what a traditional restaurant offers. For instance, in Iceland, where they don't grow too many fruits and vegetables because of their geography and their terrain and just their climate, now they do a lot in greenhouses, but traditionally they didn't have it. Their traditional recipes have very few fruits and vegetables. They're very heavy on fish or other forms of protein.
It's interesting because I love traveling. I traveled a lot when I was younger. But food was really important to me. It's like I don't want to go to McDonald's when I'm in another country, you know? I don't want to go to a fast food joint. I want to go to some place that is maybe fast food for that area, but I don't want to go someplace I could get at home, you know? It seems foolish and a waste of your trip.
I think so, but some people aren't foodies. I guess if you're a foodie and you appreciate food for the taste as well as for the culture, you'll gravitate towards dining in a local restaurant as opposed to some international chain that you could eat the same food wherever you are in the world. Everybody has a different opinion on food, but I find food very fascinating. I find food markets. I've traveled to food markets around the world, and it's interesting to see what types of stalls are manned in these food markets, where the priority of the people are, and how the people interact with the vendors. And you also get to see, you know, some of the local favorites. If you're well informed, you know, you can go and find some of the foods that you may or may not find in other places of the world. And food tours are another interesting way to explore a country or a destination's cuisine, because the tour guide cherry picks, you know, obviously their favorites or who they've contracted with, but you get a kind of a smattering of different restaurants or different kiosks or vendors that the tour includes, as well as we in Israel in the spring we actually took part in a cooking demonstration in a home in the Galilee. A Druze woman basically showed us her favorite recipes and shared them with us, and we cooked alongside with her. She taught us all types of cool things, and that I'm a fairly good cook that I didn't even know existed. So there's all types of ways to explore food when you're on somebody else's turf.
That's true. It's time to talk about your book, 100 Things to Do in Boulder Before You Die, and there's a bucket on it.
Actually, the book is part of a series of books created by a small press in St. Louis called Reedy Press. For I can't remember how many years, but I think about a decade or maybe longer. Don't quote me on that. They've been in business for doing this series for a while, but there are over 100 of these books throughout the United States, and these books all have the same. They come in different colors. The cover of the book is different, but they all have this bucket on it. And they all, where the number 100 is, have an imposed picture that is some type of landmark or some type of feature of the place mentioned in, you know, that the book covers. I knew in advance that my cover, there was no surprise with my cover. I just had to wait and see which of the pictures I submitted they would put on the cover, and they happened to choose a book of the Flatirons, which is a landmark in Boulder. Anybody that's come to Boulder, actually it's not the Flatirons, I'm sorry, it's Chautauqua. It was one of the other choices. Is actually a picture of Chautauqua, which is a national park, a historical park in Boulder. And so that's the picture that's on the cover.
Can you condense your book and say a few places that would be fun for someone who's never been to, well, not just Boulder, but Colorado?
So basically, the book follows a set format that the other books have. It has five categories, distinct categories, from food to drink, music and entertainment, sports and recreation, culture and history, and shopping and fashion. And under each of these categories, I try and make Boulder shine by pinpointing the things that you should, if you come to Boulder, you should try. But I realize the interests of, let's say, a college student is going to be very different than let's say their parent or their grandparents, and that locals are going to have a different interest, let's say, than somebody coming for 3 days. So I tried to give a cross section of places, not really narrowing in on any one audience. So some of the restaurants in the first category, for instance, would appeal to college students. There's a couple sections that deal with the bar scene. One favors college students, where the other one is a more sophisticated and mature, or for a more mature audience. I have restaurants, high-end restaurants that have fine dining, and I have coffee shops and places to go for breakfast. When it comes to outdoor activities, I have everything from going in a hot air balloon to taking a simple walk along Boulder Creek. I explain a little bit about the various options for museums, which we've already talked about earlier. So there's museums that are found on the university, but there's also museums that are located in Boulder and are either privately or run by the city. For instance, on the university, you can go to Fisk Planetarium, and which is an amazing place that's right on campus. Also on campus, you can go to a natural history museum that has tools that were dug up in somebody's backyard that primitive tools from Native Americans. Let me see what else. You can go shopping in Boulder and find all types of interesting things, from clothing that people wear for CU games, for University of Colorado games, to paraphernalia that used to be considered illegal at a store named The Fitter, where they currently sell glass pipes that they had a lot of trouble with selling when marijuana wasn't legal in the state of Colorado. You have entertainment, you have live music venues. I also include about, I think it's 12 places that are not in Boulder but can be taken as day trips for people who are maybe in Boulder for a number of days and want to spend some of the time in the mountains or someplace else. And I include places that fall into that category as well.
When you go on these trips beforehand, I assume you do a lot of research before you go. How do you like get your notes set and put it into your phone, or how do you set up for your trip?
Well, are you talking about general trips or researching
like
the 100 things to do for Boulder?
Like for a book, one of your travel books.
Okay, for this book, I knew what the parameters were because the publisher was very specific. I knew I had these five categories. I knew that I wanted to have weighted a certain way where there was a significant number of restaurants as well as outdoor things, because that's what people tend to gravitate towards. So I created a lot of initially I created my own list. And since I went under contract at the very beginning of the pandemic, things became a little dicey because, you know, the lockdowns and the restrictions, there were a lot of places that absolutely closed down, some were partially closed down, some it was unclear what they were doing, and there was also the consideration of my safety and my husband's safety. So I reached out to a whole lot of people, both that I knew as well as the people in the downtown Boulder, that oversee downtown Boulder. I reached out to visit Boulder. I reached out to a lot of entities that knew a lot more about Boulder than I did. I reached out to family and friends and created a tremendous number of lists and then categorized, put them all into categories. And then I started researching. Some of it was just Google searches, so I could see if these places were actually still in business. And then when I narrowed down my list to what I thought was going to be in the book, I started calling these places to get additional information, emailed others, and when it was safe, I physically went to visit many of these places. And over time, kind of started to have a feel for what would be in the book and what wouldn't be in the book. And then there were places that I thought would be in the book, but unfortunately the pandemic took them off the roster because they closed up. And some of these places had been in Boulder for a long period of time, and I didn't imagine that they wouldn't be in the book, but they couldn't be in the book. And then there were some places that, for instance, Celestial Seasonings, which is a tea company, they were one of the top tours in Boulder prior to the pandemic. But when it came time to submitting my transcript to the publisher, I couldn't put them in the book because they couldn't tell me when they were going to reopen again. After I did all of my research, I had to then make sure it fit into the parameters and guidelines that the publisher had provided. A lot of time was spent trying to consolidate the information and also make my writing as concise as possible, because the way the book is designed, it has to, each page has a certain number of words, and each index has a certain number of entries. So I had to make sure that I complied with what the publisher was asking for. And that took a significant amount of time. And I ultimately handed in my transcript electronically to the publisher. I think it was like the end of January, beginning of February. And the book was published on September 15th.
Cool. We're coming to the end. Where can they get it?
You can get it in a lot of different places. The best place to find the complete list is to go to my 100 Things to Do in Boulder page on the SandraBornstein.com website. On that page, I hope to keep it current of all the places in Boulder where the book is available. It's also available through the publisher, Reedy Press. You can go to my author page, the Sandy Bornstein at Reedy Press page, and order directly through the publisher. Like everything else in the world, I think just about everything else in the world, it's available on Amazon.com. But it's also available at Barnes and Noble online and in stores, Barnes and Noble stores in and around Boulder.
Great. Are you on social media? What social media are you on? And what's your handles? And what's your handles on it? That's very important.
My time is kind of at a premium right now. So while I have an Instagram site, the Traveling Bornsteins is that one. Sandra Bornstein Writer 2 is my Facebook page. While I do have accounts with both of those, I'll admit I rarely post anything on Facebook, and just because of time constraints. And Instagram, unfortunately, I stopped over 2 years ago posting anything on Instagram, because around the time my husband was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, I just totally stopped posting anything there. So probably the best place to find information about the book is the 100 Things Boulder page on the SandraBornstein.com site, because I update that with where the book can be purchased, events that I'm having in and around Boulder. I also will post a recording of this interview as well. All my interviews are also included on that webpage.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming on my show. I hope you enjoyed it.
No, I did. I did enjoy it. I remember that I was on your show more than a decade ago when I wrote my first book, May This Be the Best Year of Your Life. I remember chatting with you, and I'm glad that you were willing to talk with me again.
Oh, yeah, happily. Thank you very much, and thank you for chatting with Sherry. Thank you.